It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Jones! Bowden! He's got it! England have won the World Cup by the barest of margins!
Stokes flashes it away through the covers for four, and England have won the match!
Hello and welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket, supported, sponsored by LV Insurance, who of course are the sponsors of this England-India Test Series. It's been a dramatic series and it's come to a dramatic and very unexpected end, as I'm sure you've all heard, with the cancellation of the final test. Which of course means, Simon Mann, that there is now a debate going on about whether it's 2-1 to India or 2-2. And you predicted the series would end 2-1. I predicted the series would end 2-2. So we're both right, in a way. But of course, that is a very interesting. We'll get into what actually happened during the day, overnight and this morning in a minute. But also, we should just say there is a debate going on about whether the match has been forfeited or not. The English camp sort of think it has, but the Indian camp think it hasn't. Where do you sit?
Well, I think the ECB initially in their statement said India forfeited the match, and then they very quickly backtracked. And in their main statement, which you can see on their website, it no longer says the game has been forfeited. I can't understand for one minute how the use of forfeit got into an ECB statement. It seems ridiculous because it has so many connotations, and you actually need to hold fire on that and just wait and see. So that set a lot of hairs running early on. There was a lot, massive social media debate about whether the game had been forfeited or should have been forfeited. I think we need to put that to one side, basically, and just say the game was abandoned. It's up to the ICC to sort out what the result is. And of course, there is a possibility they might play it again. There's talk of playing it next summer, when India are here for a white ball series. And the schedule's already been announced, so they'd have to rejig that. So there is a possibility that the fifth test will be played again, or at least the Old Trafford test will be played again. Would that result of that game be tacked onto this series? Who knows? Would it be a one-off test match? Is it just a test match for money, essentially, to help Lancashire out and to pay back all or honour all the broadcasting commitments? I mean, there is so much involved when you call a test match off. I mean, in a way, especially in England, because so much money is staked on it. And also, especially when India play, because they are the financial powerhouse and they are the country that makes all the money for everybody else. So there's so much involved.
Totally right. It could be 30 million at stake for this one match. Of course, the losers are, Sky TV, the coverers of the game, and to a lesser extent, the BBC, Lancashire, and also, of course, all the spectators who were ready for the game and were travelling on the way or were already there. It's funny, isn't it? It's like there's some weird parallels with, but yet contrasts, with the game that was abandoned in 2006 at the Oval, Pakistan, who of course refused to come out after tea because the ball had been almost impounded by the umpires, who claimed there'd been ball tampering, and Pakistan were penalised 5 runs. And then the Pakistanis refused to come out after tea. And so they actually did forfeit the game. It was deemed forfeited. And the series ended 2-2. So weird parallels and yet contrast. In this case, obviously, it's a bit like admitting guilt after a car accident, isn't it? You immediately become liable as a result if you do sort of admit blame. So the Indians, if they do admit that they forfeited the game, then the compensation clauses and the insurance and all that will suddenly come home at their door, be knocking at their door for some kind of compensation, which is why they've kind of manoeuvred their way into a position where, although it looks as if they have forfeited the game because the English authorities, the medical authorities, said that it was clean, you know, that their team were clean and that they were free to play the match, but they've obviously decided they don't want to for whatever reason, and we'll delve into that in a bit. But because they've avoided the forfeit claim and said, well, we are willing to replay the match at some point, therefore they can sort of potentially wriggle out of having to stump up any compensation.
Well, I think that's the reason why that forfeit word needed to be taken out of the ECB statement, because actually there needed to be discussions around the result of the game, and it actually goes to the ICC to decide what the official state of the final Test match is. So actually to sort of jump the gun in a way was wrong in that initial ECB statement. I think that was acknowledged by the fact it was taken out pretty quickly. I mean in a way, what the result of the game is immaterial. Well, it's sort of immaterial. It's not perhaps immaterial if you had a bet on the outcome of the series. I mean, what do the bookmakers do, for example? I mean, people might say, well, that's a very subsidiary issue. But, you know, people have bet money on the outcome of the series. Do the bookmakers pay out on 2-1? Do they pay out on 2-2? Does no one get the money? I don't know what the answer to that is. I mean, that's the point. There are so many knock-ons for this. I mean, as you said, the big losers are the broadcasters, the spectators, the Manchester economy. I mean, there is so much involved. And, you know, we should look at the players as well, because what was interesting was that Tom Harrison, he came on the BBC and he did an interview, and what he talked about was the mental health issues for the Indian players. He didn't really talk about COVID, because that's been the issue in a way, hasn't it? Because first Ravi Shastri tested positive for COVID, then Barrett Aaron, the bowling coach, Sridhar, the fielding coach, Nitin Patel, the physio, and then this week, Yogesh Parmar, the assistant physio. So they all tested positive for COVID, but he didn't really talk about COVID. He talked about the mental health issues for the Indian team as being sort of the big issue. And what are we to draw from that? Well, I think that they've been in bubbles, they've been in... Over the course of, you know, quite a few months, not specifically in England actually, because there was much more freedom. But you're in this team environment, you're being tested, you're having to restrict your movements to some extent, and you know you've got another period of quarantine coming up before you go to the IPL. People within your camp are testing positive for COVID, you know, and you come into the end of a long tour. So all these things build up, and and I think that was the impression I got, that it was a sort of fear within the camp about, you know, how far this is going to spread. If we play, are we all going to be in contact with each other? Are we all going to get COVID? It seems to me that was the sort of downward spiral. And the point to make is that this is a jigsaw, and we don't have all the pieces yet. It's quite a complicated jigsaw, and we don't have all the pieces. So it's worth not jumping the gun on a few things. But that's what I would infer from what Tom Harrison has said, that it's that sort of within that team environment. And, you know, we've all been on long tours, and you know, there is that, you do get that sort of exhaustion element towards the end, and you want to go home. I mean, of course, the Indians,
it's like a horse, isn't it? A horse bolts, you know, much faster at the end when it's past the halfway and it's on the way home. And within a team environment, these sentiments can really escalate if you get a couple of, you know, quite leading players, strong voices saying, you know, we're nervous here, we're feeling, you know, the impounded, we're feeling kind of anxious about what's happening, and maybe we could get COVID, and it starts to sort of percolate within everybody, and, you know, the stronger voices win the day, but there is a momentum that is almost unstoppable, a sort of groundswell of opinion in the end within a team, which just gets more and more momentum until it becomes unstoppable. And that is that then you almost start to believe everything, even if some of it is probably just hyperbole.
Yeah, and it's been a real arm wrestle of a series as well. It's been really, you know, really tough, really hard fought, brilliant cricket at many times in the series. And I think both sides are probably quite tired. The Indians are tired. They've been here a long time. They came here before the World Test Championship final, and they stayed on afterwards. And you know, we're allowed some R&R around the UK, and then back into their bubble again. And then the series has been, you know, really, really tough. And you know, perhaps it does, you know, I think sometimes we're a bit guilty. And I looked at social media, and I think people out there, they react very emotionally to it, and they help, you know, there's lots of accusations flying around. But, you know, we often treat players like pawns, really. We don't think of them enough as people. I think that's one,
yeah, and,
one
and
thing
also,
I would say.
We're the older generation. We have to accept that. And the younger generation have different perspectives on things. And, you know, I've talked to Joss Butler about this a bit. Actually, you know, Ben Stokes, in fact, I spoke to him before he, you know, made his withdrawal in June. And, you know, actually one of the interesting characters that I spoke to a bit was Jimmy Neesham, the New Zealander, who was here for Essex and then he played in the 100 for Welsh Fire. And I was actually talking to him about the Stokes issue when I had a day with him doing some filming. And, you know, he was saying we don't necessarily, the public don't necessarily understand what it's like for the players now being consigned to these unusual circumstances and the stress involved in having to perform all the time. And then nowhere to escape afterwards. You can't go back to your natural home environment to disengage and just de-stress. You're back in the hotel with your teammates, sort of almost under observation all the time. We've had sports psychologists on our show, haven't we, talking about that kind of thing. And if you're not in it, you don't have the same sense of what it actually is like. And we can sort of accuse them of being feeble and weak. But unless you're there, you've really got no idea.
Yeah, I think that's a really good observation. That, I mean, do we need to say anything more about that? I think that you know, that really nails it.
So what's the timeline then, Simon? You know, this has been sort of brewing, I suppose, and since last Saturday when Ravi Shastri was tested positive. He'd been at a book launch the week before, which was very sort of un-biosecure, clearly, with quite a lot of people there, no masks, no social distancing or anything. And it seems to have picked up from there. So what about the last night and today when you've been in Manchester? What's been the chain of events?
Well, I think you had a sense that things were brewing when India didn't turn up to practice yesterday. It was a voluntary practice session and no one turned up. There was no media at all. There is a WhatsApp message group where the Indian press officer is involved, where he gives out information to various media. And there was sort of nothing on that. People were asking questions. You know, so there was one that said, is the test going to happen? And, you know, there was nothing whatsoever. So you knew that something was afoot. And we knew about the positive test for Yogesh Parmar. And of course, one of the issues is that some of the Indian players obviously have been suffering with injuries. I mean, you think of the last test match, there was Rohit Sharma had that problem, and there was Cheshwar Pujara had an ankle problem. There was a niggle for Siraj as well. So, you know, they were inevitably, you'd think, in close contact with the physio team who tested positive. So, you know, you only have to, you sort of put two and two together and you think, hold on a second, what is going on? But the tests came back negative. And I think, where did that information come from? Well, that information obviously got out into the public domain. You know, look, come on, we can play because, who put that out? I'm not sure, but we can play because the tests are negative. But you know, obviously, things were going on during the night. Lots of conversations during the night. I'll come to that in just a moment. But you know, when I went down to breakfast this morning, first person I saw was Jonathan Agnew. Said to me, the game's not going to take place today. You know, there's no play today. Because they want more tests, and then 10 minutes later, I got a message saying, you know, the game is going to be called off. There's going to be an announcement fairly soon, and then it was released a couple of hours before the start of the day's play. And of course, lots of people travelled from lots of parts of the world. I mean, parts of the country to watch the Test match. I think someone came down from Edinburgh for the day to watch. You know, but anyway, so you know, hugely, massively inconvenient for those people who've got tickets. First 3 days sold out, 22,000 per day, and you know, tickets are later in the game as well. All the corporate hospitality, or you know, everything really to do with the game and the Manchester economy. So that, you know, that was the sort of timeline of the day. And then the more detail, the interview started, you know, Tom Harrison coming on, and Tom, I mean, he said, you know, there'd been lots of conversations going on all night, and he did look like someone who had been up all night, clearly trying to get the game on. But and what he did do as well is, it, you know, he was extremely placatory towards the BCCI, the governors of cricket in India, saying, you know, they wanted to play the game, but this came from the players. So, you know, gradually more information, was released, saying, you know, they want to they want to play it again. And the BCCI released a statement saying, you know, we're going to have discussions about playing the game next summer. So that sort of knocked on the head the forfeit story. Which came out in the ECB statement, the initial ECB statement, which quickly changed. The game has not been forfeited. So, you know, there was a heck of a lot going on to get to the bottom line of the Test match has been called off. And there will be people who say, well, hold on a second, Ravi Shastri was tested positive during on the morning of the fourth day of the last Test match. You know, why wasn't that game called off then and there? But the requirements have changed since then. But you know, the point being, well, if it wasn't called off then, why should it be called off now? But then that goes into one or two of the jigsaw pieces that we don't have about what was going on in that Indian dressing room, you know, surrounding all the discussions about all the backroom staff who were testing positive. I mean, Alison Mitchell said she got texts from her friends, colleagues in Australia saying, you know, why is the fourth test continuing? You know, if Ravi Shastri is tested positive, he must have been in contact with all the players, and you think he probably would have been, but you know, the rules are a bit different, and on we went. But eventually, perhaps just too many people tested positive, and the players had those sort of fears, anxieties about what was going to happen next. I think one thing we should say, Oz, is about the IPL. I mean, lots of social media comments saying, well, this is fine. You know, they'll all play in the IPL, or they're going to the IPL next. This is protect the IPL. I think the point is the IPL will test. So if players, test positive, they will have to isolate for the full time. You know, so I don't fully understand that.
IPL argument. Of course, it goes back to, you know, May, when the Indian board originally tried to get the English board to bring this final test forward a bit, so that there was more time for the players to return to India and play in the IPL, or return to Dubai and play in the IPL. And that obviously hasn't happened. I think I've spoken to a chief executive of the IPL, an IPL team today, and asked him directly, you know, was there pressure put from IPL franchises to get these players, you know, back clean, you know, COVID free and all that? And he said, absolutely not. He's had nothing to do with it. Absolutely no way. All the players, when they arrive in Dubai, will have to isolate for, I think, 6 days. Owen Morgan's already there. And he said to me he'd have to isolate for 5 or 6 days before, you know, being allowed out to train. So whether they test positive or negative, they're going to have to spend a bit of time quarantine when they get to Dubai. So some of them will not be able to play in the first game or two anyway, because it starts on the 19th in a week, just over a week's time. So I don't think the IPL would have put these players under pressure. I mean, if you look at the first bit of the IPL in April, May, then there were players who were arriving and had to wait till they played. Josh Butler was one. You know, he couldn't play initially. He had to wait for a couple of games before he was allowed to play. So I don't think actually the IPL has put players under pressure to be there. Obviously, it's an important tournament. It's worth $300 million to the global game, as well as to the individual players. But I suppose the spectre of it, and playing in it for 6 weeks, more kind of security and bio-bubble sort of nature, not being at home at all because it's in Dubai, will have had a little bit of a play on their minds. But I think it was a supplementary issue rather than the main one.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose you could. One thought that strikes me is that, you know, the last thing the IPL would want would be to lose, say, the whole India squad that's going to the IPL for the, you know, for another 10-day isolation period, and then they'd have to get sort of match fit again. You know, that sort of undermines the sort of star quality of the tournament. So you want to try to mitigate the risk. You'd want to, you know, as few, if people are, have got COVID within the Indian squad, you want to mitigate that as much as possible. So, you know, the smaller number as possible. If it's two or three, obviously that's better than all 20 in the squad, because you do lose a bit of star quality. That's one thought that strikes me. There's going to have to be a quarantine period anyway. So, to me, that seems a bit of a red herring. There's been a lot of social media comment about that, but I don't totally see the logic of the argument if you think it right through, unless there's someone out there that can put me right on that and say, yeah, well, it is all about the IPL. Of course, the IPL is important to the BCCI. You know, as you say, it's worth millions and millions of dollars, but that, you know, those players are not going to be playing in it if they've got COVID. So it's as simple as that, really.
Tredegar Cricket Club has been providing cricket for the people of Tredegar for over 100 years, but in recent years, interest and participation in the sport has dwindled. A grant from LV Insurance and the ECB's £1 million Fund for Runs community initiative aims to help turn this around for the Welsh club. Unfortunately, the local authority ended maintenance of the club's cricket pitch in Tredegar, forcing the club to play outside the town last year. Their former venue, the recreation ground, has now been taken over as part of a community asset transfer, and the funding will enable the club to put a new artificial pitch back on the ground and bring cricket back to the town again. Best of luck to the club, and I hope you have a great remainder of the summer. England created an unfortunate precedent here by returning from South Africa early, a year or so ago. Actually, how long ago was it? It was the end of 2019.
It was last December.
It was last December. Yeah. God, tired. Yeah. It feels like longer ago than that somehow. So it was last December where they came home early because some hotel staff and some South African players tested positive. And so England came back early. And I know that, you know, the ECB were disappointed in England doing that. They were kind of coming back early so they could be with their families at Christmas. They were worried that if they tested positive themselves, they would have to kind of quarantine in England before seeing their family over Christmas. I think England bailed a bit prematurely there. But it's easy to sort of point the finger. But I know that the ECB were disappointed with that. And it was the first signs of player power, which we're seeing, you know, now kind of very dominant and almost escalating.
Yeah, that's right. And one of the points about that, and it was made at the time, and because it hasn't happened yet, is that South Africa series has got to be rearranged. So there's talk about replaying it or actually playing it. So it's a 3-match, 1-day international series. Of course, you know, there were television rights all bound up with it, so money for the South African Cricket Board. So presumably sometime England will go back and play it. So it's not like, you know, it's not, I mean, South Africa probably needed the money then and there, but the idea being that they will get it sometime in the future. Well, that was the theory at the time. And it's the same as this, that, you know, if this game is not played, then, you know, money will have to be handed back to Sky, for example. So there will be, and Lancashire don't want to lose all that money, so they'll want to replay it as well, play it again sometime. And of course, Lancashire hasn't got a test match next summer, so they'll be doubly keen to stage it.
This whole thing, it's a horrible precedent to set for, you know, future negotiations for sport, isn't it? Because if players are able to get matches, tournaments, you know, sort of put off or rearrange or whatever, fairly, not easily, but they've got the power to do it. Is it going to make broadcasters hesitant about bidding for big sporting events in future? I mean, now we've got the Ashes very much uncertain again. The uncertainty around the Ashes will continue because players have shown their ability to really wield the power. And England are reluctant to go to Australia without some guarantees that their families can accompany them, without the restrictions that the Australians want to put on them. So, you know, it does put a lot of these series in jeopardy. And in a way, it's one of the reasons that something like the 100 is very important, because it's domestic cricket, which a board has a bit more control over, the IPL as well. Whereas international sport, especially in the current environment with COVID raging around the world, is very difficult to sustain. You know, you don't know how different countries are going to react to situations. A country like the West Indies or Pakistan were amazing last summer at what they gave up, what they sacrificed. But, you know, Australians, New Zealanders, less willing. So it does put, at the moment anyway, in these unreal situations, it does put international series in jeopardy and therefore broadcasting bids in jeopardy.
Yeah, Tom Harrison was asked about whether the Australia series could be postponed today, and he said he didn't think so. I mean, I got a very strong impression from what he said that it would go ahead. And he used the analogy, which I thought was quite an interesting one. He said, imagine if we called off an Ashes series here. You know, what would that do to our cricket? It would rip the guts out of it of a summer, wouldn't it? Where there would, you know, there'd be so little income coming in, and I think there's that fellow feeling towards the Australian Cricket Board. Imagine if we just took the Ashes away from them this winter, what that would do to them. So I think there is a will to play, but there are still lots of questions and logistical issues to sort out in the next few months. Not least, will families be allowed to go, and therefore, which members of the England squad will go, and also where it will be played. I mean, there's a story today saying that there's a chance that the Sydney Test match will be taken away from its traditional, traditional staging time of New Year, and perhaps even playing the Sydney Test in Perth. So, you know, where are the games going to be played? I mean, there is so much still up in the air. Where they're going to be played, where and when, and who's going to be there? Which England player? Which of the England squad members are going to be there? England have just lost this series. Well, I think they've lost it 2-1 to India. Whoever goes, it's going to be a really, really tough testing series for England. I don't know what my prediction for that is going to be from this distance, but I don't. You know, it's going to be very difficult for England in Australia. Whatever happens in the next few months. But before then, there's the T20 World Cup, and you think about the Indian players looking at this. They've been here for 4 months or whatever it is. It feels like forever. They're going to the IPL, then there's the T20 World Cup, then they've got a home season against New Zealand, home series against New Zealand. I mean, there's so much cricket ahead.
It's 24/7 cricket, isn't it? Yeah. 24/7, 12 months of the year. I mean, especially if you're an Indian or an English player. So let's just think about the cricket for a second. The series is over, sadly, an anti-climax. What's your highlight? I mean, I'll give you mine. I think my highlight of the series was actually the batting and the bowling on that first morning at Lord's, where the situations, the conditions were very conducive to bowling first, and England bowled brilliantly and they couldn't get a wicket. And I thought the batting particularly of Rohit Sharma was wonderful to behold. And, you know, when you look at somebody like him, a white ball specialist who's made several double hundreds in white ball cricket. He's an absolute elite player in opening the batting in 50 overs and T20. Captain of the Mumbai Indians, who won the IPL so many times. Never made 100 outside India in Test cricket, though he's made plenty in one day cricket. And just the abstinence he showed, the beautiful technique that he exhibited, the patience, the ability to recognise the situation and not go for big shots and just play a resourceful game and try and make 100 at Lord's, which he'd never done, which ultimately he was denied by the most brilliant delivery by Jimmy Anderson. That duel between Anderson and Rohit Sharma during that morning session and then sort of afternoon was absolutely wonderful. So for me, and Rohit really won that battle. And I think India, even though they're 2-1, series victory is sort of Pyrrhic in a way. At the same time, they were slightly the better side, and I thought that spell of cricket sort of encapsulated it.
Yeah, I mean, India's opening partnership is actually one of the crucial aspects of them winning the series, because KL Rahul made 100 in that test match as well, and then Rohit, of course, made 100 at the Oval in their two victories. So there's that. Also, I mean, amazingly, really, when you think of how England started the series, the question marks over their opening partnership, we've now had 200 stands for England's opening partnership as well, between Burns and Hamid, but at Headingley and at the Oval. So, you know, a few sort of green shoots, I suppose, as far as England are concerned, at the top of the order. I mean, yeah, Rohit and KL Rahul, Bumrah, those, I think...
Yeah, Bumrah, those two wickets in, at the Oval, yeah. Bumrah, you know, knocking yeah. over Pope and Bairstow, brilliant as well. Yeah, took the wicket out of the equation.
Yeah, fantastic. And India's irresistibility, if I can say the word, on the last 2 days of the Lord's Test and the Oval Test. You know, England going into those sort of days with an opportunity of possibly winning, drawing certainly, but then blown away by, you know, brilliant Indian cricket on the last day. Absolute highlight of what has been a riveting series. But also we mustn't forget, there's one person we haven't mentioned here, we mustn't forget him, and that's Joe Root, 300s in the series. And sort of dragging England's batting along just about. And you felt at times it hasn't been Root this summer. Well, this year, in actual fact, it isn't going to be anybody. And and someone, or more than one, needs to step up and support him, really, if England to have any chance in Australia. Well, I mean, England have played, what, I think 12 test matches this summer, this year, and only one other player has scored 100. Root scored, what, 6, is it? And only one other player has scored 100, and that was Rory Burns earlier in the summer.
Well, I've just written a piece for the next Cricketer issue, actually, which is out in a week's time, about Joe Root. Do we anoint him as England's greatest ever player? Obviously, it's a debate which is difficult to have because, you know, the greats of the past, like Walter Hammond and Len Hutton and Jack Hobbs, people like that, you know, there's no real footage to really... compare them. They're playing in a different era, but certainly in the modern era, sort of since the 1970s, the last 50 years, no England player has averaged 50 in both formats consistently as he has. He scored more runs in a calendar year already than any England player has ever done. He scored more hundreds in international cricket, 39, than any England player has ever done, and he's only 30. You know, so what ever he's going to achieve. I've calculated to overtake Alistair Cook's eventual target of 12,400 runs, Root needs probably about another 38 tests. He's averaging, I think, about 85 runs per test. So if he gets 85 runs per test for the next 38 tests, he will overtake Alistair Cook. And that will take him, COVID escalations permitting, that will take him about 3 and a bit years, 12 tests a year, 38 tests in 3 and a bit years. So he'll still be less than 34. He'll be 33 years old, potentially, and overtaking Alistair Cook's record. Well, you know, if that doesn't make him the greatest England batsman of the last 50 years, I don't know what does.
No. Well, he's been phenomenal this year. Because what he has done is, remember there was that criticism, turning those 50s into 100. And he, you know, not only has he turns 50s into 100, he's actually turned 100s into double 100s. This year, but there needs to be some support for him. Yeah, you mentioned three of the greats of the past. I mean, I suppose the player in the modern era, since I've been watching to rival him in terms of quality, Kevin Peterson, fantastic player, to watch. Brilliant.
Just a hard player to manage in the end, I think. I mean, I was just, this is a sort of, I suppose, more of an emotional and slightly sort of tenuous argument, but he was just, in a way, Peterson was alternately incredibly self-confident and actually unbelievably fragile. And over time, he took a bit of time to manage. And funnily enough, you know, you think about it, Root came through when Peterson was in slight decline. And in that big series, 2013-14 Ashes, when, you know, Mitchell Johnson was raging through England like a wild bushfire, Peterson was asked when Trott went home, Peterson was asked to bat at 3 and refused. So Joe Root had to bat at 3 and got dropped after the fourth test, came back strongly the following summer and never looked back.
Yeah, well, he's had a great year. Other top, we're sort of riffing a bit here now, but other sort of top players in my watching lifetime, I mean, in terms of pure pleasure to watch, David Gower. And then Jeffrey, of course, was a phenomenon, and then Graham Gooch as well. So those are the three from the past you mentioned. And then we haven't talked about the likes of Dexter and Cowdery and May and that, you know, those type of players, and Ben Barrington, those sort of players before we were born, before we were watching cricket. But
might be before you were born. I saw him, Colin Cowdery. Colin Cowdery was my first hero.
He was
getting towards the end, I'm sure.
I did see some of Cowdery, of course, 74-5 in Australia on the TV highlights.
He was the first autograph I ever got, actually, Colin Cowdery. I went to Canterbury in about the early 70s, and yeah, he was my hero. Well, I saw him score 100 for England on his 100th Test appearance at Edgbaston 1968, and I was hooked thereafter. Obviously, could never bat, but I loved watching him.
Well, I forgot you were a closet Kent man. I always thought you were Middlesex, but you revealed not so long ago that you were a Kent supporter when you were younger. I think we should probably just end the podcast, Yoz, by sort of just looking at the series and sort of, you know, best series in England since when? I mean, it has had so much intrigue, hasn't it? And so much excitement and sort of to-ing and fro-ing. And, you know, England had that amazing win at Headingley, but blown away on the last 2 days at Lords and the Oval. And, of course, they might well have lost at Trent Bridge as well. And they've had their top order rearranged, which we thought could happen, but it might actually, as it turns out, it might actually be for the better for them, going to Australia. But
I suppose best since 2005, probably. I mean, the 2009 Ashes, when Panesar and Anderson held out at Cardiff, and, you know, Australia looked as if they were going to take that series really initially, but then England managed to regroup and eventually got it themselves. I mean, that was quite, you know, there was a brilliant test at Chester Street when Stuart Broad raged through Australia. Was that 2009?
That was 2013.
And that one, the first test, England won by 17 runs when Anderson got the last wicket Brad had in. Pretty good. But I think probably this series had more ebbs and flows, really, and more uncertainty. I think it gets my vote as the best since 2005, I reckon.
Yeah, with an incredible sort of remarkable conclusion to it. I think that's the thing. I think so many people going to Old Trafford with a sense of anticipation over the next 5 days. Actually, I mean, I was in Manchester today, obviously, and the weather was fine as well. A lot of people saying it was going to rain today, but I think, you know, we would have played probably from the start, and by the time I left, it was still dry, and the forecast not too bad. So, you know, so over the next few days, we could have had more thrilling cricket, and we wanted more as well, because the Oval had left us with that feeling of anticipation, but it wasn't to be. And a remarkable sad end, really. There's been a great series, and I do feel extremely sorry for Lancashire and for Manchester as a sort of a city, really. So it's sort of staging a game, and so much goes into it, and it left with that sense of anticlimax.
Sadly for readers of the Cricketer magazine, of course, this has all happened after our issue has gone to press. So none of this will be covered in the next issue, which is out in a few days' time. But ironically, we have got Joe Root on the cover looking agonised as he'd got out at the Oval. And that's pretty much the last action of the series that we've seen. Obviously, India 2-1 up. So it sort of left kind of precariously poised in the Cricketer magazine. Well, now we all know what actually happened. So it's sort of almost a suspension in time, I think, the next magazine. Obviously, no podcast to bring you as a result of the cancellation of the Test match. But I have got one little kind of thing in store, which is I did an interview the other day with the young Warwickshire star, Chris Benjamin. So we'll release that later, perhaps at the end of the weekend. Very interesting character, very talented player, made a 50 on debut for Warwickshire in the Royal London Cup, a 50 on debut in the Vitality Blast, and then 100 on debut in the County Championship last week. So a very exciting young player who you've probably seen play in the 100 for Birmingham Phoenix. Very interesting character, wants to be an international, may just be the next Joss Butler. I've just kind of given him that tagline, probably quite hard to live down. But that's on the podcast list next for you. And as I said, the Cricketer magazine out next week as well. You can subscribe to that by going to www.thecricketer.com. And that's it, I think, for this week. And a bizarre end to a great series. And the arguments will run and run about what the actual final score is, I suppose.
Yeah, and people will have their own views about what we've said on this podcast as well. But that's how I see it. That's how you see it. And it's for everyone else out there to agree or rage away.
Yeah, and actually rage away. Let's give us a review of this podcast. You can do that. But if you go to iTunes, there's a space there for posting a review. And also you can put your own opinions as well. We'd love to read them and we'll relay them on the next pod. If you either put them on the iTunes site or perhaps on one of our Twitter accounts as well, we'll read out the best ones in the next show.
Great. Thanks very much for listening. Back soon.
Podcast Network.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right, ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.